Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odysseus Magazine. Lucha Week concludes with a Megapod with our pal, Dr. Lucha Steve Sims. We talk about the CMLL anniversary show, the Rush vs. LA Park match, Sexy Star unmasking, breaking news while we were recording of Pentagon Jr. winning the AAW title in Chicago, WWE's interest in luchadors going forward, how La Sombra has been making out in NXT, the demographics of Lucha Underground, and also, since Steve is from San Diego, we talk about two things that have happened in his town recently, the baseball All-Star game and Comic-Con, which is going on as we speak. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. We conclude Lucha Week with our friend Dr. Lucha Steve Sims to talk about all the recent news and some of the goings-on in his nominal hometown of San Diego. How's it going, Steve?
Well, it's going fine. You happen to be calling me at the time that the Comic-Con is wrapping up, the annual Comic-Con is wrapping up. And after we get through Lucha stuff, I think we will have a most interesting conversation. It's not particularly wrestling oriented, but we'll refer to it and stuff. But there's a lot of interesting developments going on when you talk to people who were at the show for the last 4 days.
Yeah, I used to love to go, and now I don't know if I would go for free. So
well, that's
yeah,
how
so
I first talk. That's how I first met you when you came to a show.
Right. So I guess
let me ask you. I'll start as the guest asking you a question. How did we end up in a year where Pagano and La Máscara are the heels and our two biggest matches of the year? It's like, is this like the year where everything, this is the most horrible year of our entire lives?
I guess the only good thing that we could say, well, I mean, everyone's saying what a horrible year this has been with all the deaths and things in the news and politics and whatnot. So I guess it's fitting that you have like a garbage wrestler in the main event and well, I don't know. Would he be,
you know, their version of Roman Reigns, the guy that the promotion just pushes and pushes and pushes and nobody buys him?
Well, I don't know this off the top of my head, but is La Máscara, he's not the worst member of the family.
No.
So I think he's just bland. And it's funny because you have a guy named La Máscara, which might be sort of like the blandest name you could give a wrestler.
Yes, that's true. But they owned a thousand different, well, not a thousand. They owned several different copyrights and trademarks and stuff like that. You could think they could come up with something better than something just almost generic like that.
La Máscara won the Leyenda de Plata last night, beating Negro Casas in a fairly cheap finish that involved Tiger distracting Tarantes, and La Máscara gave Negro Casas a foul, and it was a fairly anticlimactic match, but I guess it now seems like we're building to La Máscara probably versus Rush in the anniversary main event, would you say?
Well, I'm always holding out hope. I'm holding out hope that they've got him booked next week against Dragon Lee, and in this very same tournament that you just referenced, the qualifying Negro Casas was the defending champion, so he automatically advanced to the finals. That's just the rules of the tournament. And then they had the week before a 12-man elimination tournament to determine the other finalists, and it came down to La Máscara and Dragon Lee. Dragon Lee is the brother of Rush, and Dragon Lee it's when they got the two of them together, La Máscara was clearly beating the crap out of him, and it certainly appeared like he was well on his way to victory when Rush came down. And now, next week, they have a singles match with La Máscara and Dragon Lee, and you can speculate all sorts of things that might be going on from there, but will they give La Máscara one more trophy so that he is not destroyed by and sent back to mid cards or sent to mid cards by losing in an anniversary show main event, or do they have something really wild and wacky up their sleeve that will end up with Rush not only going after La Máscara but possibly going after LA Park? this is fan fantasy. This is not necessarily anything that anybody has told me for booking purposes or
Well,
any source they
I
hear.
guess the good thing is at least that we or we're probably getting La Máscara versus Rush. We could be getting La Máscara versus Dragon Lee, but we're not getting La Máscara versus Puroff.
Yes, they and somebody finally convinced them, and somebody within their home office book finally convinced them that La Máscara winning over Pierre Roth Jr., even if it might advance a storyline, would be the sort of victory that would not add any luster to La Máscara, and might actually take some luster away, because the odds the part of the match would be so horrible that you couldn't do anything with it. So yes, I'm very thankful in a year where a lot of things all over the world have been unusually dark and grim and dead and death full of death and stuff like that, that we didn't get at least the worst anniversary show build-up match that they could have done.
And like you said, we now have this feud between Rush and LA Park, which apparently is now being taken around the country after they had that crazy brawl in Elite a couple weeks ago.
I have not seen a match in a while that resembles that from CMLL. It's not that they've not done things like that in the past, but it's extremely rare. They generally don't allow wrestlers to just go in business.
Rush or talking about them going into business for themselves.
Well, if you see the match, and if anybody hasn't seen the match yet, I and everybody else on Twitter who has seen it has recommended that people go and see it. It is.
Well, if you go to the pod 2 pods ago on our show with Cubs fan,
Yes.
the Lucha Azteca YouTube footage of that match is up on our page so people can see it there.
Go there. Yes, absolutely go there. If you don't want to see one of the periscopes, which is the first way that I saw it. But it is a wild match. It's a crazy match. It's two people that are willing to throw caution to the wind when they get in the ring with each other, and just go out there and just kill it. It's something because a promotion never does a match with foreign objects, or very rarely, and never does a match with blood. It's been forever since we've done a match with blood. This, of course, sticks out a lot because it's just so different from what they've done in the past. And it gives the guys a chance to explore a side of the business that's now well accepted in drawing money, and it makes you wonder why CMLL doesn't do that a little more often.
Well, I know that that's something that people who listened to last show when we talked to Sam Adonis, he was talking about that match and how fired up the crowd got, and he made the point, and I'm sure you know this well, that people love the flash and the sizzle and the dives and everything, but when you've got just a bloody brawl, the kind that Paraguayo used to do, that'll really get people motivated.
It will, they've had a very high quality of young fire come through since about the Imbusco de Ídolo of about, what was that, a year and a half ago? Two and a half years ago. And they've run Atlantis in the main event stuff, and they've done Mark, a lot of the same things over and over again for the past 3 years, and this just really stuck out as, oh, look what we also have in our arrow, or what the arrow we have in our quiver. Look what else we have in our arsenal that might actually, excuse me, that might actually work and get our guys over. Of course, the fans were already there in the arena because they knew that Park is liable to do something like this, and that Rush is just crazy. He's just
Park off of being Hank.
People know what they're getting when they come, when they get with him. They know for a fact that he is in a large way the ultimate independent contractor in Mexico, and he tends to listen to no promotion. He doesn't have a promotion to work for. He doesn't have a secure schedule for the next few months unless he goes out and books it himself. So he doesn't have to obey by quote-unquote CMLL rules, and Lucha Elite already wasn't completely obeying by CMLL rules. They were bringing people back like Park or others that, that supposedly Paco Alonso wouldn't have in CMLL. But it's an amazing match to see. It's a match where the referee called for the finish and called for a DQ, and then they went on and continued the match regardless of that for a few minutes afterwards until they started doing microphone challenges. And, you know, it almost makes you wonder if as much as it's designed to appear as if they went off script and went on their own, every once in a while when I try and describe it to somebody else, I think, well, you know, this might have been just a well-thought-out angle to try and get a elite version of an anniversary show, mass versus mass match, that might draw $1 million.
And certainly, based on last year, people in Arena Mexico are probably trained that if you give Park a mic, you don't know what he's going to say based on what happened last year.
Yes, that's true. Well, based on the rest of his career, it is true. He will say anything. I mean, when Antonio Pena tried to take the gimmick back away from him, he went out and did something that nobody in the world expected. He said, well, my name is Adolfo Ibarra Tapia, and that is who I am. And he kept the mask on but revealed who he was underneath it anyway. And nobody in a thousand years was expecting that. It's way out of character for Lucha Libre to do that. So he is definitely marching to the tune of his own, he definitely marches to the tune of his own drummer.
Although, we just recently had another voluntary unmasking. Not quite the same
situation.
Yeah.
A very sexy one. You're going from one of my favorite wrestlers, and I will put one last coda on L.A. Park, as I have been trying to do for the last 10 years or so, is I think he belongs in any Hall of Fame, Lucha Hall of Fame, Waterloo Hall of Fame, Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, WWE Hall of Fame. It's been, 92, Quincy Principe in L.A. Park. So it's been, 24 years under this particular gimmick. And everywhere, almost every time he's on the card, he's the most interesting wrestler on the card. It's, I just can't see why people, I suppose it's his WCW tenure. You know, that ended 18 years ago. He's just been legendary in his gimmick, and I don't know, can't do it. But now off to from one of my favorite wrestlers to one of my least favorite wrestlers, and I use the word wrestler in a completely different light when we're talking about Sexy Star. But boy, do they have similar egos.
I know when we talked to Cub the other day, it's just so strange because it's like, you know, she's going to be in next, you know, the season of Lucha Underground that they've already taped. That's all we'll say for people who are worried about spoilers out there. So, you know, are we going to get the situation
where she is, but then again, it's a taped episode. So theoretically, now that she's taken her mask off, the producers could theoretically say, of course, we know there are some results in there that would be really difficult to explain if you excised her totally from season four. I mean, you would leave some gaps that they would really have to almost refilm and rebook. But so I suppose they don't. But, you know, theoretically, they could just write her out.
But I think it would be funny if she's wrestling in Lucha Underground, quote unquote, you know, the next fall, masked, and then not wrestling in Mexico, but maybe boxing, or, you know, if she actually goes through with it.
Something that would be aware to. I think most of the fans who follow Lucha Underground, the hardcore fans, Will has picked up by the time season four airs, and of course it'll be shared on Twitter and other stuff as season three episodes come along. That, oh well, you know, she's already voluntarily unmasked at a boxing show, so It's yeah, she's just she is really, really, really in for her own business. She's really a self very self-focused person. She has had reputations of not playing along with the promoters, with programs they wanted to run, with not being willing to drop her mask, with not being willing to do jobs, with being a very how shall I say, disagreeable person in the locker room. So it puzzles me why, out of all the wrestlers in the world, because you can always put him under a mask. You can take a guy from Kentucky and put him under a mask and make him into a lucha star. I mean, of all the female wrestlers in the world, why this particular one is the one that they're hanging their hat on as the empowerment source.
I don't know. I agree with you. I've never really been a fan, so it's like if she didn't constantly make news, it's like I would be more than happy to like not really talk about her.
She
Before
does it.
we
She's
go,
good at that, isn't she? She is. She knows
yes.
how to keep her name in front of the public. I hope that this is being mean. I apologize ahead of time, but I hope she really does start a boxing career. I hope she does.
We actually have this is rare on the podcast, but we actually have breaking news. There are a couple shows going on tonight as we're taping this Saturday night, Sunday morning. Lucha Memes or Terra Lucha and Lucha Memes are they have a show that I have not yet seen the results of, but according to our friend the Cubs fan, Pentagon Jr. has won the AAW title in Chicago tonight.
Well, and Cubs fan would know he is there, right?
Yeah, he is there in.
He's there. So this is not just a report. It's live reporting, the best kind. Maybe if he's lucky, he can get the International Hardcore title while he's in the U.S. for a while. Find out who's got it and make sure the referee's there.
Yes, according to the Lucha Blog Twitter, he won the match and he dedicated it to Pero Jr. and
Whose
will
birthday
be
was
rest
this week? Yes.
yeah, and will be wrestling Ciampa on the next show. So there's that. We don't know about the show in Mexico, but
Did it
our
say when
friend
the
of the
next show is? Because isn't Ciampa wrapping up to go to Orlando full time?
As I am, let's see.
I mean, they're gonna have to. I guess
The wonders.
is Ciampa booked for PWG in 5 weeks?
I
I'm not
don't
sure. I
know.
honestly don't
I am.
remember all 24 of them. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I am not a PWG guy, so I am not sure. It just says his tweet just says Pentagon versus Ciampa, Berwyn Eagles Club. So whenever, I assume that's next month. So.
I would guess it would have to be, yes. I have heard, and I suppose this is a topic we could tackle if we want to talk Lucha, but I have heard that some feelers have been sent out that NXT has decided they're going to do another round of hiring in the fall and another one in the winter, and I don't know that the winter one is yet public, and that there would likely be consideration given to Rush and Volador Jr. As possible entrants. And if you suddenly find in 2 weeks that Dragon Lee is putting out his mask against La Máscara and stuff like that, there could be a signal down the road about that too.
Well, it's funny that, if we had known about, about when La Sombra's timeline took place last year, I think more of us would have not picked him to lose his mask at the anniversary show, since Rob was the only one early on record saying that he was going to lose.
And
But yeah,
that's
it's
true. And I remember that when Brazo de Prada was brought in to eat a ham hock, eat a leg of ham, it was actually like 3 or 4 months before he did film that skit that he got the contract sent to his house.
But that leads us to Máscara Dorada, who has signed. He's been in round one of the Cruiserweight tournament as Grand Metallic. I would say
And he will be Grand Metallic as long as he's in that tournament.
but I don't think he's probably odds on to win, but since he's signed, I think it's certainly possible he could go to the Final Four, maybe.
Well, we yes, we it's it is, but then again, who did they have? Did they bring back Tajiri? And
I think Tajiri lost his match, so I think Tajiri's going to be around, but I think he lost in the tournament already. But they have so many of these indie darlings. Can I safely say that?
Yeah, well, that's
You
fair
know?
enough. Yes, they have to. As time goes by, now that the draft is over, the impression that I get, and I think the impression a lot of people get, is they feel as if they need a few more bodies on SmackDown and on NXT, and they're going to go out and especially with NXT, where you can put them through a training class and you don't have to debut them immediately, and you can kind of draft 12, but bring eventually hire four or five or six. I wouldn't be surprised if three or four Lucha guys kept it. And
And
maybe
that
even the Golden Links, Lince Dorado.
which leads us to the luchador who actually is in NXT right now, the former La Sombra, who I would say has sputtered so far
Yes,
on his.
sputtered is a good word. I was talking with several people at the Figure Four Wrestling Observer Newsletter convention in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago, and almost to a word, people were going like, "I'm not getting him. I don't see what the big deal is. He's got the stuff some of the other people have, but he's just not sticking out to them." I think a lot of people think the name is really stupid. The name is a drawback, not a help, and frankly, his look, and I mean look above the face, above the neck, with the way his hair is and stuff like that, it strikes me as that's not the best way he could be presented.
To me, and this is something we discussed a couple days ago, it seems he's just more suited to be a heel. And he certainly was a Technico before, and he was a good Technico under the mask, but he has that look and that swagger that he should be a heel.
Well, his run in Los Ingobernables, in the Ungovernables, Los Ingobernables, was I think the high point of his artistic career and the high point of his getting over as a character. He's able to work either style. I think both of us would agree with that. I mean, he can be a good guy, a bad guy, and WWE will of course take his or any other luchador's they hire style and quote unquote Americanize it. That's just going to happen. So he'll be trained in the ways they want him to do certain things. But I just, for whatever reason, he's not. He's the crowds that go and are not predisposed to like him, not predisposed to hate him, just see him against other people, and always comes off second best in the charisma department. That's the constant impression I'm getting. That's a tough
Which
thing
is
to
fun.
fix. The
Which is
best.
funny because, he had such. I mean, I know I don't remember if you or one of the people said it, but I know if people have said that, you could sort of almost see his facials underneath his mask when during the Ingobernables run. He was just so great at conveying feelings.
It was not me, but that is a very good way to put it, because that is true. It is, and I'm not a great person. I'm not even a great person for taking people, who put back the mask on, and I know what they've looked like for 10 years, and then seeing their face under the mask. I'm not even all that good in putting all those features together. I tend to see the whole character, but that's a true statement. He is now doing the sort of He's lower on the cards than I thought he would be, and he's doing more jobs than I thought he would for somebody who was their more or less their first pick to be the new wave of Mexican wrestler, the good employee Mexican wrestler. So, we'll see.
But it's the kind of thing where if they end up with 3, 4, 5 luchadors, you know, are they going to try and make them all different, or do they all just become part of the machine?
I suspect that they are looking for one that can really stick out with charisma. They want somebody, if this is more or less publicly stated it's not something they would deny or it would be any surprise to anybody listening. They want a somebody to be the next generation of Rey Mysterio Jr., Eddie Guerrero, as far as being a Hispanic superstar that Hispanic fans would get behind and help with that demo. It's always, anytime you put Rush in with anybody, Rush has such a tremendous amount of ring charisma. It's like, well, it's amazing La Sombra had as much charisma as he did, because Rush can be kind of like the nuclear, the supernova star next to two other, red giants. But still, I mean, he is so charismatic. It's as Rob had mentioned in a Twitter post earlier this week, you don't know what kind of problems, if any, WWE is going to have with Rush with how he gets his physique. I mean, if they're not going to do anything with Brock Lesnar, I suppose that the answer to our question in the end, they're just, if he's their chosen darling as the next Hispanic superstar because of his charisma, then his physique will be able to get by. Let's just say he will be able to skate in that area. But my question to you is, do you think that with the modern way that WWE books, with less wrestling and more angles, the main rosters, long skits, long talking, I mean, you know, stuff like Eddie and Ray did to make both of them into a main event program was basically done with angles and skits and family members and ring entrances and stuff like that, rather than just the matches. The question is, do you think WWE is going to give somebody who doesn't speak English great that leeway to try and become the next Hispanic superstar?
You know, I think they tried it with Alberto. And
they did. Well, anyway, I'll let you go ahead and finish, and then I'll tell you my Alberto.
But, you know, on paper, it's like, on paper, theoretically, he had everything they would have wanted. It's like, you know, he's big, he's handsome, he speaks English, he's, you know, an above-average worker, you know, but did he not have the charisma that they wanted? Did they want a guy to do flashy lucha as opposed to being a guy who was more of a base? So.
Or did Vince just go sour on the character and just after the first couple of months just start beating him and beating him and beating him, just like he did the second time around? He loses a lot. You know, buddy, you know who would make the. Of all these guys except maybe Rush, and Lord knows that Máscara Dorada is my favorite and Volador Jr. is out of this world. But you know the one that I still think has the potential to be the next Mexican superstar in WWE is Hijo del Fantasma.
I can see that.
We'll see. We'll see. But I suspect there is all of them have a chance, but he is a old chunk of coal that is just one step away from being a diamond, and I think he can do everything they need in the style they need, including the promos. That's just, you know, that's just, it's an opinion. It's a case where even if Triple H sees it one way, or Stephanie or Shane sees it one way, Vince, still to this moment, that day will come, and it's not that far away, but still at the moment, Vince, everything has to go through Vince. He still micromanages everything. And I just see him taking a look and saying, this guy can do the angles that we need and the speeches we need right now. And if he had him, and this would go, let's put him up at the top.
You know, that place is so fickle. Like you said, you never know. It's like they could bring him in. He could have a great match in his debut, and he could thing, and Vince makes up on the wrong side of bed one day, and that's it, and you're done. You know, it's, you know, there's certainly 20, 30 years of great guys being brought in that company being wasted. I mean, not everybody is as horribly wasted.
And, you know, he doesn't look as good as Rush. He doesn't look as good as Volador Jr. He doesn't even really look as good as what they had pictured for Sin Cara. But just like, you know, Ray was undersized and Eddie was undersized and Eddie was somebody who let the burdens of the industry, like being champion and stuff like that, get to him. After a while, Vince was so happy with the work they could do in setting up programs that overrode everything.
But, you know, you look at a guy like Claudio, who, you know, is big and strong and the kind of physique Vince loves, and he's amazing in the ring, and not only does he speak English, he speaks like four languages,
mm-hmm.
You know, but there's just something about him that Vince doesn't see, and so he's going to be, you know, mid-card forever until he leaves and, you know, goes on the indie scene and could very well be making more money than he makes now, and he goes to New Japan and he goes to England. And he does the super indies, you know, where people sort of quote-unquote get him.
I have a question for you. What do you think the business will look like 5 years from now, just high level? Are you one of the many who think that as soon as Vince passes that WWE will take a big tumble, or do you think it's going to be a situation much like where UFC is headed, that you've got a very small, relatively small audience willing to pay just anything for their favorite hobby?
I think it's entirely possible that it's a better entertainment product, but less successfully financially. Because I think you will have a certain percentage of people that will, like corporate-wise, that when Vince is gone, you know, they'll be gone no matter how many, you know, boards that Stephanie is on and
mm-hmm.
all the, no matter how much sort of aesthetically pleasing Hunter can, you know, NXT is his baby and the Cruiserweight thing, and, you know, and it's all great and it's great workers and having great matches and all, but, you know, that's not going to make them a $1 billion company. It'll secure his base, but it'll probably shrink. You know, I wouldn't, you know, I could see them, you know, losing one of the TV shows on USA if the numbers go down. I mean, I don't think they'd lose all their TV. I don't think they would go completely 100% on the network, because I think that would be a kiss of death. And I think they'll still be sort of, family friendly. I mean,
you and your work are involved with a lot of, you know, thinking about what the future is going to be like 5 and 10 years from now. How do you think people will get their entertainment 5 or 10 years from now? Will we be all streaming by then, and the network will just be an internet site?
I wouldn't be surprised.
It's just
if it's
5 years. 5 years is too soon, and what I'm describing is fine in 15, but just not 5.
Maybe it's, you know, things are growing so exponentially that, you know, between tablets and phones, you know, and the more, in 10 years, the more people who, are traditional TV only, there'll be less of them, and there'll be more young people who cord cut and do stuff on their phones and on their tablets and that kind of stuff. So all I hope is that in 5 years that we finally have a la carte cable. I wanted a la carte cable since the mid-80s.
No
I
bundling.
know they're finally getting close to it in Canada, I think, but that's again, I have persnickety tastes, so I was always bought, we didn't get cable until like the late 80s when I went to college, and
Holy cow, that's late.
and then we we only, well, I'm in the middle of the country, that when we had 40, I think we had like 40 channels, and two-thirds of them I couldn't give a hoot about. Do we need, I kind of don't even know how many news channels actually existed back then. It may have been just been CNN and Headline News. But you've
That's
got, you
all I
had your
remember,
like,
yeah.
but I mean, you had like your three or four religious channels and your business channels, and it's like, I was somebody who could have, give me like our three, your three networks, your two independents.
Yeah, ESPN, Sports Channel Mid-Atlantic.
Which was home team sports then. That's
Yeah.
how long ago this was.
That's a filth. That's a filth.
Philly had
Crazy.
Prism,
Yeah.
owned by Ed Snyder,
Yeah.
I think. So, yeah, and I probably, and I don't know if there's so many channels, I'm not even sure if they exist yet. AMC existed. I don't know if Turner Classic existed then. But and your HBOs and Cinemaxes. But yeah, now it's like, when we had DirecTV and you scroll through and there's like 40 or 50 channels in a row that you don't really care about and you're paying whatever for.
Yeah.
I mean, I could, and this will sound strange, but I mean, I rarely actually watch ESPN, and if you told me that you could take away ESPN and my cable bill would be $7 less, that'd be fine with me.
That was
It's like,
and it's happening. I mean, that's the I think the big sports business trend of this year is that ESPN is like in the death spiral.
I don't know about that because, I mean, it's still Disney at the end of the day. But yeah, I think they're like under, I think they're
Your
under
dream
a
would
hundred.
kill them, ESPN. If people could unbundle it, yeah.
Because
Because the
how many people,
cost of live sports are enormously expensive.
and then you have those poor people like our friend Fredo, who can't watch the Dodgers in his own hometown because
Yeah,
his
that's right.
cable company doesn't carry the Dodgers channel.
You
Well,
know,
that was,
for $2 billion, they lost a chance to make a difference with or are losing a chance to make a difference with another generation of fans. I mean, I don't know. $2 billion
see, that
is a
was always,
lot of money. It's a lot of money, though.
well, see, that's the thing. It's like where I live, I live in between Baltimore and Philly. So growing up, we got both sets of networks. I mean, we had a rotor. This is because before we had cable, so we had a rotor, so we could watch all the Baltimore stations and all the Philly stations, depending on how we pointed the antenna. But once we got cable, it was funny that we're in Maryland, so they gave us home team sports, but technically, where I live is part of Wilmington's media market. We're not actually in the Baltimore market, which means theoretically we're in the Philly market,
Yeah.
but we're in
You should have had
Maryland.
Prism.
Well, yeah, how much? This may have been like by the time it was Comcast.
Comcast, yeah.
But yeah, so it's, for like for hockey, it's like the Capitals are 2 hours away, yet that's what we have on our TV
the Flyers are an hour away, but we can't watch them. And then you start getting the weird blackout things, and we would start getting, like once we got like CSN Philly and once Masson existed, like they both were blacked out when they played at home, and then they were blacked out on the MLB package.
Yes, that would cause me to
Another.
drop MLB TV after a while.
And that was, it used to be annoying. The two of the like, I don't know, 30 whatever teams that I could not get as part of the Major League package, could not get the Phillies because they were the local team, so we couldn't get, and I couldn't get San Diego because that's like when they were on Channel 4,
Yeah, they had their.
and there was, yeah, and so that wasn't part of the package, even though I'm out of market. So then it became like, well, why do I have this if I can't watch the local team and I can't watch my favorite team?
Well, you think about Southern California, where everybody, all the teams are classified as local teams, the Padres, the Dodgers, and the Angels. So it's like, why would anybody in Southern California subscribe to this?
Well, I know it's not baseball, but I know now there's apparently all this negotiating going around with the Las Vegas hockey team. Because they're trying to figure out the TV rights, because I guess Vegas is either the Kings or the Ducks or both.
It's considered in
So
the
now,
Dodgers market for baseball. That much I know for a fact.
so they have to like redraw the TV map, and then I think they have, they have to pay some kind of indemnity to Fox Sports because, they're taking away part of their market. And then that's some weird things when, when you get new teams and teams moving. And of course, the stuff with Masson is apparently still this humongous mess with the Orioles and the Nationals. And I think I read the other day that it's going to some sort of arbitration thingy, whatever, to finally get it straightened out. And you have the thing where, Oakland wants to move to Santa Clara, but they can't because that's technically the Giants territory, even though the two cities are right next, how,
Yeah,
why is.
even though Key.co Stadium is actually closer to Santa Clara than AT&T Park is.
But
It's
it's all crazy big
all
business.
big business, buddy. Hey, I have to ask. I want to ask you another question back to Lucha again. It is my opinion, my stated opinion, that the most amazing statistic in professional wrestling these days, the most amazing thing to me, at least, is that the average age of somebody who watches Lucha Underground, based on the most recent stats I have seen, is a male age 49. How do you think that happens? I would presume that what I am seeing, this following statement is a fact, that El Rey is not aiming it at 49 and 50 and over year old men. They're aiming at a younger demographic, both for advertisers' reasons and for artistic reasons. But it's not what they're getting. And I'm puzzled to death as to why they're getting a different audience than the product that they're making is designed for.
My first guess would be if that's the demographic average for Lucha Underground, but does that mirror the demographic for the channel as a whole?
Well, they've only got one other show, so even if I had the answer to that question, the answer might be that just like, yeah,
Because anecdotally, the people that I know that watch that
the numbers are
channel,
just too
not.
the N is too small.
Well, the people that I know that watch that channel, that watch the Grindhouse movies and that watch the Kung Fu movies and all that stuff are guys my age. They're guys in their 30s and 40s. It's not, I mean, admittedly, I don't know many young people, but I know, the people that I know that watch it are in my demographic, if not
Yeah,
age.
1849, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which I can see. I can even see them trying to aim at 18 to 34s. But certainly half of their audience, which is admittedly a small number being over that, there's a certain possibility. It's a possibility that the only people that are watching are that because that's the only people, who can get the channel are people in, certain, you know, you have to already have cable TV and already have so many bundles, you have to be fairly well off financial to even be able to add a small channel like this into your bundle. I don't know.
Now, I don't know the answer to this, but am I right in remembering that for season one, that there were more viewers on Unimas than there were on
LRA? Yes, correct. By a noticeable amount, yes.
And now, but that show's not on anymore, so they lost. But I wonder, what were the demographics like watching on Unimas? Was it skewing the demographic they wanted?
That's a good question. I may be able to get an answer on that. I don't know an answer off the top of my head. I have been told by a couple of people that the reason it was on Unimas, or reason it was offered to a Spanish language network and created a Spanish language version, was to try and market it throughout Central and South and Latin America. So they had, you know, they were making a deliberate business decision to do that. And the business decision may not have even really cared all that much about the ages and the advertisers and stuff like that. They just wanted to create the show, to try and sell it to somebody else, particularly Televisa.
Well, see, this of course goes to the heart of why I don't watch. And as I have repeatedly said, and I know people are probably tired of hearing about it, is Lucha Underground is a television show with wrestling, not a wrestling television show. And so the former doesn't really interest me. I in no way take away, like, I know it's good. I know the matches are great. I know they have lots of great workers. It just, I don't know if it's because I think it is a telenova that uses wrestling as its plot device.
That's like Santo Blues, yes.
But see, I don't even see it as I guess they sort of are Santo movies, but it's the paradigm just makes me not interested. And I think part of it is also the fact that, you know, I prefer not to patronize AAA, and, you know, most of the luchadors are from, you know, it's a AAA co-owned, co-branded, however you want to say it. So, like, if Lucha Underground was with CML, that's what I have probably watched it, maybe. But I think I would still sort of have the same fundamental problem with it. And again, that's why, like, I mean, we talk about it on the show sort of in passing when there's news, but it's like, I also don't have El Rey. So not that, you know, that would actually be a real problem.
Yeah, not in this day and age, no.
Not in this day and age. Not when I watch.
Which, of course, that's another answer to my question is that the fans, if they want to watch it, are watching it. There's just none of them, or half of them, aren't watching it via that particular distribution channel.
Right.
Those numbers are not going to be coming out. We're not going to know for sure how many iTunes subscriptions they sell. We only know it's going well, but that's their definition of well.
I wasn't even thinking about iTunes. I was sort of thinking of the gray area of the internet. You know, so like how many people torrent it, especially because how many people can't get El Rey. And you have the thing where that demographic that they're going after are the people most inclined and more technologically savvy to be able to do it, or they just watch stuff on YouTube. Or now that you can download them from iTunes, there's probably a certain percentage of people who may have been getting it through the gray area now go, I have to pay now, but it's much easier to go to iTunes and download this and pay, $2 an episode or $20 for the season. We watch at least 3 CML shows a week. 2 of them are right there on YouTube, which is the easiest thing in the world. And then the Claro Sports is fairly easy. I mean, everybody posts a link to it on Friday, so it's not like it's difficult to find. Now it's going to be on New Japan World, And if you miss all of those things, you wait for Cubs to download it or upload everything on Tuesday.
Okay. I have a question for you then. Let's take soccer, for example, or football, if you prefer. The Jornadas have started in the Mexican Premier League now, and I subscribe to Televisa Deportes and TV Azteca Deportes. And as soon as somebody scores a goal, of course, they're going to broadcast the goal on their Twitter feed, or maybe their Facebook feed. It's mostly Twitter feed that I see. But it's not available in my country. What is the promotional advantage for Televisa to block all their American, Mexican, football fans, soccer fans, from seeing the goals as they happen? Why would you even want to do that? Why wouldn't you want your people to see that?
The easy answer is probably because they want somebody to pay them the rights to do that. So they want, like, MX wants Univision to become, like, their American digital partner so that, because they have this in England where, I don't know if it's all the Murdoch papers, but certainly the Times of London has an app called Goals. And so they have the right that as soon as someone scores, it gets put up on their app. And the app is like $2.99 or whatever. So
but
the problem, of course, is
it's regionally restricted.
Legal, right. But I'm saying there's like NBC probably has something similar here for the Premier League.
Yeah.
Where if you have the NBC Sports app, well, of course, if you have the NBC Sports app, you can watch all the games at one time if you want. Or they're all available at the same time, I should say. So
yeah, but it's just you know, why doesn't just have a Goals app of its own where people can anywhere in the world can watch the goals as they happen? I mean, it's not the most important soccer league in the world. It's only the home soccer league to a lot of people in Southern California.
Well, see, the other problem, of course, is I was going to say that, you know, the Times has to deal with the Premier League, so you have to buy their app to see their goals officially. The problem is, as soon as someone scores a goal, 10 seconds later, somebody has put the GIF online. So then you have to start playing the cat and mouse game where somebody posts, you know, there are minions in the Premier League headquarters constantly searching on Twitter. And as soon as they see somebody post that, they flag it and get it pulled down. Because, you know, speaking about baseball being greedy again, you know, baseball has one of the sort of the most draconian social media things about posting clips and whatever. You know, this is something Simmons always used to rail about on his podcast.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like it's promotion. But then you look like the NBA and the NHL are very GIF friendly because they just see it as free advertising. It's like, you know, if Alexander Ovechkin scores this crazy goal, they want it to go viral. And so they don't – the benefit of making people go to NHL.com or NBC Sports to see it is out – you know, the bad will is much outweighed by the goodwill of everybody in the world being able to post this clip because it's just advertising. But baseball being baseball, you know, has to be – you know, proprietary.
Yes, they have the antitrust exemption, of course.
Well, not only that, is they also have BAM, which is, you know, like a license to print money. I mean, it's so good that people, including the WWF, hire BAM to run the network. And yeah, baseball was certainly ahead of the curve on all that stuff. And I mean, I think BAM is probably like, at bat is probably the best of all of them.
Yeah. It was, yes, as long as you're sitting in Southern California and you're interested in seeing the game between the Royals and the White Sox, it's great.
Well, see, one again, if my team wouldn't have been stubborn, like, you know, I'm an out-of-market fan, so, you know, I don't necessarily care to watch Baltimore or Philly, usually, you know. But if I can watch San Diego or San Francisco or Seattle.
Seattle, yes.
Then I was happy, but then, of course, I couldn't watch San Diego. So, which brings us nicely, in a wonderful segue, you were not at home while this happened, but the All-Star game came to your town a couple weeks ago.
The Home Run Derby came here, and then they had a scrimmage the next day.
So, how did
seriously,
that go?
Seriously, I left out of here Monday afternoon to go up to, back to LA for Tuesday morning, and there was way more focus on the Home Run Derby than there was on anything else going that entire weekend. Futures game, All-Star game, ridiculous. What did you say? Four different varieties of the same 60s Padres mustard brown.
I believe what in uniform parlance I believe they are called the Taco Bell uniforms.
Yeah. I heard them call that, but I don't think around San Diego. I don't think that's a very considered a compliment.
No, but that's. But, like, in sort of, like, uniform nerd circles, like,
yeah.
You know, like on Paul Lucas, those are sort of, they're called the Taco Bell uniforms in the same way that Houston's uniforms are called Tequila Sunrise.
Uh-huh.
So that's sort of become the parlance.
In my life, I have been to Taco Bells where the people behind the counters wore a clothing scheme that was exactly like those, a couple of the Padres uniforms from the 60s. You know, Ray Kroc was a McDonald's guy. I guess it's just he was never going to have people dressed up as Ronald McDonald. So this Taco Bell was as close as he got. But
although for 90% of the Padres' history, Ronald McDonald would probably not be far off the mark.
Yeah, well, that's another story. There is, Mark, over the last few years, there has been a gradual, very slow diminution of interest in baseball in San Diego. Between just the Padres being good and the fact that night games at the stadium are considered locally very difficult to attend because of, you know, when people leaving their house trying to come through rush hour for a 7 o'clock game because rush hour here ends about 6:30 or in San Diego ends about 6:30, and then you're trying to get back and it's 10:15 at night, and if it's a close game, everybody's leaving at once, and there's not a central parking lot, and the trolley is very, very limited in the number of people you can carry, so people are parking in private lots or private parking garages, and everybody leaving at once, and it's a mess to get out of town, so it's considered a very inconvenient place to go. The Padres, except for the occasional year here or there, haven't gone very much, and the new ballpark glow has worn off. So things are just and you add the fact that at any given time it's still a military town, so you've got a whole new set of people who really aren't from here that are fans of this team, that team, or the other team. And if that team happens to be coming to see San Diego this year, they'll go see them from Coronado or Miramar or wherever the military bases they're at. But it's a very odd market. For a county of 3 million people, the fact that it's only the 26th largest TV market in the country, it's like the third or the fourth most populous county in the country, but 26th most TV market. It's a very, very strange business climate in San Diego.
Now, since we are talking about demographics, are the Padres popular across the border, like in Tijuana, or do those people sort of like want?
They were, but after about 2008 or 2009, the cross-border office of the Padres and cross-border efforts dropped just drastically. And there are still some, and there are a lot of baseball fans in Tijuana, and Tijuana's not that far away, but the border situation gets worse every year. It gets tougher and tougher and tougher for a Mexican citizen to cross the border, and it's very difficult for them to come and see games, so they have to watch what they can on TV. And, of course, the TV is now that Channel 4 San Diego doesn't exist anymore, is more regular and hard to get. So there's just a lot of reasons why they haven't driven the Hispanic or Mexican audience very well the last few years. You know, you go to L.A. and the radio announcer in L.A., Jaime Jarrín, for the Los Dodgers on Spanish language, is as revered a announcer in his market as Vin Scully is in his. Well, maybe Vin's a little more, but I mean, that's how seriously Jaime Jarrín is. Really, really, it's hard to explain to people who don't know that, but he's really well thought of. There's nothing like that in San Diego. There is a Spanish language broadcast, but I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen it get a rating, a high enough listenership to draw a rating.
Now, to go back to Lucha for a second, so this is something we always like to talk about. What if I was in town for Comic-Con, which we'll get to in a second, and I wanted to go to TJ last night to watch Lucha, where is it now on the safety scale?
It's better. It has gotten much better. There's the one major financial reason is because after 2011, tourists from all other countries except the U.S. stopped going crossing the border from Mexico to Tijuana and stuff like that as it became more difficult. And the tourism business in Tijuana fell drastically after 9/11, 2001. And it's not where it was, but it's picking up a little bit. But they are so anxious for Americans to come across the border in today's economy in Mexico, the value of a dollar is the highest it's been in 15 years. And they are so anxious for that spending to occur in their city that you're actually, they treat people very well. You never, ever hear stories of people being asked for bribes, people having, you occasionally hear a car theft story, but that's about it. You don't hear, taxis taking them out and then robbing them and stuff like that, like you used to hear in the 90s when I got here. It was a much, much freer border. I guess there's a better word than freer, but I'm not coming up with it. It was a much more fluid border, and there was a lot of activity, and the market was much more integrated than it was now. Now it's Tijuana is a sad remnant of what it used to be.
Which, going to echo back to one of the things we said earlier, that also explains why the difference with the dollar explains why so many luchadors are taking so many U.S. bookings now. One, because it's hot, based on Lucha Underground, and like we were saying, there may not be many viewers, but they're rabid viewers, and they're certainly turning out to see guys wrestle in Los Angeles or in Chicago or Cleveland or Atlanta, because all I hear is, yeah, these guys are super hot, they're doing super business with merch, and being paid in dollars.
So much so that Phoenix's brother has moved to San Diego. Phoenix Pentagon Juniors, or Dark Pentagon, or whatever name he is most commonly known as, has moved to San Diego, and they are brothers. So who knows? Maybe Pentagon will work more out of San Diego and more out of the U.S. than before. And who can blame them when they get so much more money? As long as somebody like Lucha Underground doesn't go all high-minded on them when they're trying to sign autographs at Comic-Con, but I suppose that's a setup for you to talk about the politics of Comic-Con.
But it's, I would assume also you have a thing where, everybody who works for Lucha Underground, being that it's like an American television show production, like I assume everybody's paperwork is immaculate, So you don't have to worry about randomly booking, even going through like the CMLL office. You know, do you have to, you know, I assume there's no issue about guys with visas and all that other kind of stuff if they've been working
I
on it.
assume there are too. There used to be. I used to hear that as an excuse a lot, and I always wondered whether it was a true story or just the excuse that, you know, they drank too much last night and overslept their flight or whatever it was. From the 80s, from the 90s, I used to hear that excuse, and you rarely hear the excuse of visa problems anymore crossing a border. So, you know, in the modern era, I don't think it, you know, the with the opportunity of making so much more money on the American side of the border, I don't think you will find too many more guys that if they have visa issues, won't be able to fix them quickly.
And I mean, if you're say Pentagon Jr., who may be arguably the hottest of the Lucha Underground luchadors, you know, and has now been given a belt in Chicago, versus what I think people who watch AAA might call his frustrating booking there, and the way people are jumping off of that ship, which is another thing where we seem to always talk about. And, you know, the person that I expected to be their last is, of course, now their most vocal critic. But, you know, I mean, if you're Pentagon, I mean, other than maybe for it perhaps damaging your relationship with Lucha Underground, it's like, yeah, why wouldn't you stay in San Diego and take U.S. bookings and then once a month or how often does AAA tape TV? It seems like they cancel them fairly frequently. And so it'd almost be like working for TNA. You know, you work all these other independents and then you tape 6 months of TV at once or 3 months of TV, whatever. You go to Orlando for 3 days. It's like you live in San Diego. Once a month, you go to Mexico City or wherever they tape AAA. You know, and the rest of the time, you work in Chicago or Atlanta or LA or BOLA or whatever else. You know, strike while the iron's hot.
Well, I would if I were in their shoes, and I still stand by my earlier this year prediction. That probably isn't the best order, just kind of educated guess and hunch that AAA's business model and the amount of money they've put out in expenses versus what they're getting back from Lucha Underground and other things are all adding together, where I would be more than 50% surprised if at the end of 2017 they were still in existence in the form they are now. I honestly think they'll sell themselves off to a bigger company, but I could even see them folding. So
Or, yeah.
I definitely think people like a Pentagon or a Phoenix, who probably see the inside of the office the same way that Conan does, are looking at themselves and say, if I can get a foothold in the U.S. market, you know, if now is the time when somebody's willing to open the door for me, I'm going to go crashing through and, you know, make it or break it.
And certainly, you know, I mean, we've seen that the Lucha Underground contracts are fairly
Restrict
onerous.
it. Restrict
But
it. You can't even sign autographs? No, seriously. Seriously, that's all that's doing is building up your stars for your own show, even if it isn't somebody else's booth.
yeah, what I was going to say is that I would assume that even if they're under restrictive contracts, they're still letting them work indies and they're still on their TV so that when their contract is up, that Hunter can say, people know who you are across the country. Come with me. You know, rather than, you know, just going, you know, taking people out from CMLL or wherever else.
Well,
You could
that
certainly.
brings up the question. If Lucha Underground signs Pentagon to a contract, what does that mean? If they are signing to a contract, telling him what he must work, telling him how he must work, whether he wins or loses, does that make him an employee? Does that mean he's eligible for health insurance benefits? Does that mean he's eligible for the rights of a California employee, which, trust me, for those of you who don't live in California, are massively better are massively more numerous. You get more numerous rights. California is a state that a human resource director for a national company loves to hate because of all the rights employees have in California. So,
well, now here's an interesting question.
Very interesting.
And yeah. I assume this does not, this may not matter between U.S. citizen, not U.S. citizen, but I said earlier that I consider Lucha Underground a TV show with wrestling, not a wrestling TV show. Do the guys who work for Lucha Underground, can they get SAG cards?
I would presume so. I mean, I would think the same thing would hold true if you were a Canadian actor coming across the border, if you were a British actor coming, working in the U.S., if you're working, if you're under contract to a U.S. promotion or U.S. TV show, a U.S. Opera,
so,
U.S. symphony orchestra, I would think you would be eligible for perform for the rights and unionization abilities that anybody else who works there has.
In that case, if Lucha Underground, if I was under contract to Lucha Underground and a member of SAG, then I would say, I'm under contract, I'm happy to do whatever you want. You know, you can't jump ship or whatever. But, you know, if I'm under contract for Lucha Ground and I can't work for
6 months,
CMLL, or I can't work for Vince.
Anywhere for 6 months. Let's say that's in your contract.
Now, does that mean you can't work anywhere, or you can't work anywhere that they don't approve?
Well, I mean, it's whatever it says in the contract. I think this is, as long as they are paying you during the period at which you are not currently scheduled, you don't have actual work to do that week, but they're still paying you, then you're legally, this is going a 20-year conversation ago with Bob Barnett, but I believe that you are still considered a live and active employee. It has to do with teachers. It has to do with teachers that take the 3 months off during the year, and in many cases, it used to be the case for those 3 months, you actually didn't do any work. And there are actual rules in California law about considered employees, even though you have a significant downtime.
It's funny because here, I know lots of teachers who all had summer jobs because one of the teachers owned a pool business because my dad did the electric for them. And so there would be like three or four teachers who, you know, for summer built swimming pools. And that's what they did during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not working, and that's the perfect time to put a pool in.
It reminds me of the old stories of football players who were wrestlers in the off season. They had a, you know, contract to play for the LA Rams, and then they went and wrestled in the off season.
And guys, and there are certainly plenty of wrestlers who made more money wrestling than playing football.
Oh, yes.
But going back to that,
yeah,
I would say if I was Pentagon Jr. and I'm under contract and they let me work indies, but I can't work for CMLL.
Any indie that will put you on TV. That's correct.
Right. And so, but then I'm making, and then it's like, well, is Lucha Underground taking a booking fee, or are they just, they don't care what I'm doing as long as, you know, I don't, you know, get crippled?
Yeah,
or
my understanding is, in this particular case, my understanding is that AAA takes the booking key, and it was booking fee, and that was written into the contract when AAA became a part funder of the original Lucha Underground Corporation.
But I would still say, if I'm Pentagon Jr. and they let me work American Indies, and okay, AAA takes part of my booking fee, but I'm keeping my merch money, then I would probably do that.
Yeah,
I would do that until they told me I couldn't, because, you know, you're not doing anything, and I mean, you may be getting a stipend, but you're also sort of not performing your craft, and, you know, wrestlers only have a certain shelf life. You know, you have to make hay while the sun shines. So, yeah, I mean, now if you make such a big impression that you're Ricochet, And allegedly Vince has a con you know Vince has a six-figure contract for you, then it may be different. But then it's also he's also an American, he's not he's
He
not
is, and but I also know that, Lucha Underground, El Rey, and the people behind them have X amount of money, and WWE has X amount of money, and a lot of times when you are moving from a, when the person who feels aggrieved is the person that has the less amount of money in the lawsuit, sometimes they just have to throw up their hands and say, "We might win this, but it might cost us way too much money to win this."
And if we're talking about non-competes and things like that, I think history has shown that non-competes generally don't hold up.
Yeah, it's tough. It is really. I've seen more cases in my lifetime I can think of where they say, in the end, you can't restrict to somebody from making a living.
Back to Comic Con. So we'll talk about Comic Con. I'm not there. I had a bad experience the last time I went. That I just really don't want to go back as long as it's the size that it is now. And this is, what, 4 years ago, something like that?
5 years. 5 years ago, I think.
It was, well, it was, then it was the height of Twilight Mania.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that even though that doesn't exist anymore, there's millions of other things that has taken its place. And so I thought it was too crowded when it was a third the size it is now. So I really have no great desire to ever go back. And plus, now everyone is so wired. It's like it used to be, if you went to San Diego or one of the other conventions, it was really the only chance you ever got to talk to people. But now everyone's connected. Like half the people I probably would have wanted to see in San Diego, I've had on my podcast. So it's not like I don't talk to them, and I don't talk to them on Twitter, and I don't talk to them on Facebook. Or whatever. So to me, it's not worth it. But you were telling me before we started the way attitudes may have shifted a little, especially in town.
It is. It's gotten, of course, it's gotten very, it's gotten so, they have become so efficient at their space. And a lot of it, I guess, has to do with the fact that this year there were a lot of VR virtual reality demonstrations and stuff that apparently didn't, for whatever technical reasons, means they could get their products and or new concepts to the fans in a smaller physical space. They didn't need as much space per booth was the story coming out of it that I heard, and that a lot of people were like, this is way, 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 way far away from what the just the general concept of a Comic-Con is. I mean, it was bad enough when it became just highly corporate about 4 or 5, 6 years ago, and it was the place where you're debuting your latest movie for this, and stars come in and sign for like Twilight, et cetera, et cetera. And where the I don't want to say sold their soul, but the people who were running the show maximized their income with a revenue stream that hadn't been available to them, and they may have gone a little overboard with it. And a lot of people felt like that they didn't stop going to Comic-Con. Comic-Con stopped presenting a show for them.
Well, I know that the last time I was there, 'cause, and that had been 4 or 5 years since the last time I went. And in that time, yeah, it was a lot more, because that's when the movie studios really invaded. And then, like I said, everything became super commercialized. Like it used to be in the 90s, when you went around town, you knew Comic-Con was going on because you had the, the things from the street lamps and stuff in windows and whatever, whatever. But that's when it started being like every hotel had a deal with somebody, so there was banners and they decorated the elevators and all of your hotel keys were sponsored by some movie. And what started happening then, and I don't know, I think it's still going, it's still going on now, but people actually started setting up little mini cons around town.
Yes,
Like
yes.
they rented space, which I was always a proponent of. that like, you know, people rented an office, like a shop space, sort of in the regentrified part of the gas lamp, and then just set, that's where they set up. They didn't set up in the con. They said, you know, we're not, you know, we're like, it was like a boutique publisher. So they had their four or five artists who were there all day, and they would go back and forth. But so they were set up, and you know, they were selling prints, and they had signings, and they were doing all this stuff there. So you did not have to deal with the mass of thing. The anecdote I always tell people, and it's slightly disingenuous because I know now that I could have done things differently, but I always say I was in aisle roughly 1100, 1200. So down in Hall A. And I had to meet somebody in Artist Alley, which was like 7800 or something like that.
Yeah, effigy.
I had to meet them in a half an hour to pick up a piece of art that I had bought from them. But I only had a half an hour because they were going to be on a panel. So they had to leave for a while, and I was only there the one day. So I had a half an hour to get there, and I did not get there. Now, of course, the trick is I could have
Going
gone
outside.
out the gone
Going outside.
outside, walked around,
Yeah.
and it would have been fine. But the point is, I could not make it in a half an hour from one end of the hall to the other.
Which is rough for most people listening, it's roughly a mile.
The convention center is huge, and then for a while it kept growing and growing and growing, and now I think there's no room for it to grow anymore. Now that they have the hotels down there at the other end, didn't used to be there.
The hotels, and they're thinking of putting a Charger Stadium at the one end too.
So they can when they're playing in Los Angeles.
Well, you never know.
And I was telling somebody the other day, I said, can you imagine what it's like this year now, with it still probably being like that? But now you have all these people playing Pokemon Go that are going to be running around the convention center doing that. And just, like, it's not been, one, the amount of people is humongous. And then you start adding in giant displays so people stop and rubberneck. Understandable. You have the people in costume that people want to stop and take pictures with, especially if they're attractive young ladies with not much clothing. So that clogs the aisles. You know, backpacks, stroller. It's like being in Times Square, like at 5 o'clock on a Friday. Which is why I don't want to go back anymore. But I mean, I say this and people tell me too that it's funny that there actually is a great Comic-Con buried in the middle of that. The problem is you can't sort of get to it without all the other stuff.
Yes, you have to go through each hour 45 minutes of work to have the 15 minutes of the pleasurable parts.
And there's just some, and there's, and it is, and on a certain level, it's cool that everything's popular, and you know, part of this probably is the whole I like this band before they became big. But, you know, it's like there's no guarantee that you get into a panel that you want now. And now there's all these weird ticketing rules and wristbands, and like, because squatting became a huge issue for a while, especially for the media things in Hall H. Like, if you wanted to see the cast of the Avengers at 3 o'clock, then you just went to Hall H at 10 in the morning and sat there all day. Through.
They debuted Star Trek Beyond this year, and you know, had the whole cast down here Wednesday and Thursday, and like, apparently it was just a zoo.
Imagine if the movie had been any good.
It could have been worse. I saw somebody wrote a review like that. It could have been worse.
Yeah. That was, I, what we said leaving that the good thing was, instead of being an overly complicated deep movie with, I guess there's some of this, but it really was sort of just an actual episode of the TV show. Just huge.
So are you giving a shot that it just wasn't a standard J.J. Abrams action movie?
Yeah, and there's weird issues that I have with it too, but it was, I mean, I thought it was fine. You know, some of the acting was good. The Algerian woman who plays the alien, I thought was good. Some other people were good, but you know, Idris Elba sort of wasted under all this makeup. It's like you don't even know it's Idris Elba until sort of the end. It's like just let him be Idris Elba. But anyway, but this kind of thing I really had.
Look,
no...
I still haven't recovered from the. From going to the second movie, the one right before this, not knowing ahead of time what they were going to do with it, and then when Cumberbatch says that his I am Khan, I walked out of the theater.
See, I did not like the first one, so I really had no desire to see the second one, so I haven't yet, and I wouldn't have gone to see this one, but it was like. I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and we're like, and we're both Trekkies, so it's like, well, might as well go. So, I mean, he's probably going to see it anyway, and I was like, well, I'll go. It was a matinee, so it's not like we paid full price or anything. Now, this usually surprises people, but I am very picky about the genre stuff that I actually do and do not see, because... It used to be, you know, like in the 80s, it's like your genre stuff was so infrequent that you kind of had to support your team. Like you have to support the Padres even when, you know, they lose 110 games.
Yeah.
But now it's like the geeks have won and there's so much stuff, then you sort of owe it to be discriminating. Because it's like, on one hand, do I need to see... Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, to be able to accurately say this is a steaming pile of crap? Or do I know intuitively this is going to be a steaming pile of crap and I need to vote with my wallet and not give them my $10? Because the only way they stop making bad things is when they don't work at the box office. And admittedly, if a movie makes $300 million, what's my $10? But you sort of, to me, you have to be principled about it.
But, and I try to be too, but of course that sort of movie is made for an audience of an age that doesn't have that level of discernment yet.
Right. And the other thing is, and this is sort of true with Star Trek and it's true with a bunch of things, it's like, I've become more and more distanced from contemporary popular culture, and I'm more and more interested in old popular culture. One, because sort of as a former academic, I'm interested in sort of learning about it. And two, it's sort of, in a way, it's better made and worse made at the same time. But it's interesting. And so I sort of read. And now everything's available. I mean, there's stuff that, like, I may have seen as a kid that was adult, that wasn't for me, but is now easily available so I can appreciate it with an adult critical eye. Like,
Rocky and Bullwinkle?
That, and but I was thinking, like, I've been watching, I went through a thing about a month ago, like, I watched a ton of Columbo, and now I'm watching, like, a bunch of MacLeod.
Have you hit Kolchak the Night Stalker yet?
Yes. I was going to say, if you've seen my Facebook post, you know that I burned through those a couple weeks ago. And I'm sure you were amused by the thing that I posted, in that the most fanciful thing that I saw in an episode of Kolchak was not the fact that it was an episode with apparently an alien that was invisible that had superpowers, that was trying to steal metal to repair its spaceship so it could leave Earth. Now it's the fact that this was all taking place on the day of Game 1 of the first Cubs World Series since 1945. and they were playing the Red Sox.
Hey, that's so what kind of got this fall, so hey.
They were going for like these super fancy and during the episode he keeps getting in his car and listening to the game on the radio, and it's uncredited Dick Enberg, who is now the Padres announcer, going back full circle. I was always a proponent of taking stuff out of the con and doing it like around the city, especially if you were, I mean, not if you're Marvel and DC, you have to stay in the hall. But if you're like a secondary publisher, like if you're Dark Horse or somebody like that, you know, you're going to be swallowed up by Marvel and DC plus by Disney and Fox and whoever else. It's like, so like ran out like two of the halls in the Hyatt. Or the, you know, the height, you know, whatever.
Well, you want it to be close. You don't want it to be like, you know, 2012 WrestleMania in New Orleans, where WrestleCon is by the Superdome, but the Mid South get together is like 15 miles away.
Yes, I know, because I was set up at that.
Yes. You don't get any serendipity 15 miles away.
No, and you know, in a way, it's fine because the people who knew that was going on and the people that came. So, but I, yeah, cause I know I went downtown cause I went to Access, and I know that I walked by, I think where WrestleCon was, cause I think it was like in the convention center or something that, cause I know like I went to that casino that was down there while I was waiting to go to Access. And I know I walked by like the marquee that said where WrestleCon was, but yeah, everything was, yes, I had very bad blisters from walking around Bourbon Street that like that whole week. But yeah, I was thinking, I think it's the Hilton is like the newer one that's like sort of past Hall H, sort of near the stadium, because I think the Hyatt is by
A and the Marriott's all the way down at the last one, way down at the end,
right? Yeah, because the Hyatt is where, that's where the Marvel and DC people stayed, and that's where the Eisners used to be, and the place you always went like the Hyatt bar, like on top of the hotel, was where everybody wanted to go. But of course, after a while, I stopped going to the Eisners because I wanted to go to Lucha. That was always the dilemma, that I knew like three or four people who were wrestling fans who every year I would try and get to go with me or with Eric to TJ. But unfortunately, they always had books that were nominated for Eisner, so they couldn't go. Or they were presenters if they didn't actually have a book out that year. So it's like, I'm like, one year we're going to go, but we never did.
And to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't a card this weekend other than – there's always cards in Tijuana on the weekends. But, I mean, these are the Coliseo Coacalco 100, 200 people cards. I don't think there was anything at the Auditorio, the Hippodrome, any Titan shows, any Crash shows. I don't think they even count really on people crossing the border anymore for that.
See, I've always said – I think we've discussed this before – that, you know, I always said, like, one of my sort of, like, lottery wishes is, like, Tuesday of, like, Comic-Con week to, like, if I had, you know, infinite money, would be to, like, book, like, a fairly decent-sized Lucha show in San Diego during Comic-Con. Like, not against the con, but, you know,
but
maybe Thursday. Yeah, I mean, you've got like 200,000 people in town, and it's like they're comic book nerds. I mean, you only need like 1% of them to want to come to your wrestling thing, and you sold the building out. And because you assume, you know, like if you run a gym somewhere or, you know, like in a perfect world, you know,
well, yeah,
with all the money in the
San
world.
Diego, I don't know if you know this, but San Diego City College is only 1 mile north of the convention center, and they have
Yeah.
their community college gym there.
But I mean, you know, if you had all the money in the world and you wanted to rent the sports arena, you know, which I assume was like 15,000, something like that.
Yeah, there are parts they rarely open up anymore because it's old and beat down, and it's the worst current arena of a major city that I can think of. It's in bad shape.
But again, theoretically,
Theoretically,
you
yes.
know, but you know, like if you could go to, especially, you know, like if you run like on Wednesday, like if you run a night that like CMLL doesn't usually run, you know, and you go to the office and you say, I want like 10 guys, and not like all the, you know, you don't need all the superstars, but you know, you get enough of them, and you book them, and you book like some American indie guys. You
Yeah, I'm
know,
sure Steve Payne would be able to get you some guys.
but you know, so you would probably, you know, and you had big names. Like, well, I guess now you'd probably, I don't know if you'd get the Lucha, but anyway, so you get, you know, I would be confident you would get a couple thousand people with all the people in town for Comic-Con. And so, like, that was always, you know, if I had all the money in the world. One of the things I would have done is run a big Lucha show during Comic-Con. Because it seems, in my head, it seems like a natural. Because it's like you're in San Diego, you know, you're not that far away. And again, this is, of course, this is all actually before 9/11. So, but you would have probably had people come from TJ if you had like enough, you know, I mean, like you booked.
If it were easy.
Yeah, if it were, and this is, again, when I used to sit and dream this all. Stuff all up, you know, it's like you had Santo and Wagner and Casas and the Guerrero, you know, Ultimo and Bucanero. This is like this is people from this time period.
Yep, and Porky.
And Porky, you know, that I think if you would have like all of them on like a big American show and then some like notable American, like probably guys who weren't working for Vince anymore or whatever. I think they would have been a decent show. I mean, yes, it probably would have lost a ton of money, but the point is it didn't matter. But it would have been fun, I think.
They did it in conjunction with the Orange County Fair for about 2 or 3 years, and they brought Santo and Wagner in for that. Very interesting. But now, of course, it's much too crowded, and all the available parking is just snapped up as quickly as a space becomes available. It's a convention that both the city of Anaheim and the city of Las Vegas which are two larger convention centers than San Diego, has been putting in increasingly competitive bids to where I think in 2014 was the last bid, that Las Vegas basically won the bid, and San Diego City Council and mayor and stuff came up with some tax breaks and perks and stuff to get them to stay one more cycle. But I wouldn't be surprised if it moved to Las Vegas when the next round of bidding is up. It's just too big for the convention center that San Diego has now.
See, I think, and it used to be, I think part of the thing was people liked being in San Diego for a week. You know,
It's, you know, being
think of it
in
this way.
San Diego in July is a lot better than being in like Phoenix, Anaheim, or Las Vegas in July.
I was gonna say, would you want to be going to Comic-Con this week in Las Vegas?
Not particularly, no. I
I mean, it's.
understand it's such a giant convention center, you don't have to go outside, but still.
But I mean, but. You still, but you're not there 24 hours. You know what I mean, it's like, I mean, if it's been 95 here, I can just imagine what it's like in Vegas right now. It used to be, yeah, it was the great, it was the cool part was going to San Diego for a week. And I always, I mean, I had a feeling that once it became sort of movie con, that moving to Los Angeles was more and more of a possibility. But the people that run Comic Con moved one of their other conventions to Los Angeles, I think. Because it used to be, I may have this wrong now that I think about it, but it used to be the
It
people that,
sounds familiar. It sounds familiar. I know
Well,
that.
I mean, Wizard runs Los Angeles, but the people that run Comic-Con also run WonderCon, which used to be in San Francisco, but they may have moved it to Los Angeles and moved it back, or they may have moved it to Los Angeles. But then again, it's like, well, if you're in LA and you're like a movie guy, like, do you want to just get away for the week and go to San Diego as opposed to just driving across town for this stupid convention? I don't know. So
it's those are all very interesting questions, but
it would certainly be nice if the movie people, again, this isn't going to happen, like if the movie people pulled out and then it became a smaller con so it could stay in San Diego, and they split it.
Yeah.
And like
that has been discussed.
Like all the popular culture or the movie and TV stuff goes to LA and the comic stuff stays in San Diego. But see, the thing is that Marvel and DC are now just subsidiaries of Warner Brothers and Disney.
Basically, yes. They supply.
Yes. My favorite phrase.
Intellectual property that they build the movies around.
I was going to say, they are what is called in the business IP farms now. Like, really, the comic books could be lost leaders especially for Disney. Because if you think about it, you know, probably like the publishing budget for the whole year of Marvel is like an accounting error for Disney. And all of those books pay for themselves if they have one movie that makes a tenth as much as this Avengers movie. Or even better is when there's something small that nobody knows about that somehow somebody options because they have a good idea for the movie. And it like, do you remember Big Hero 6 from like 5 or 6 years ago?
Vaguely.
It was like a Disney animated, but not Pixar movie. But anyway, that's based on a Marvel comic that you've never heard of.
I've not heard of that.
But Disney made it into a movie, and it probably made a couple hundred million dollars and probably a couple hundred million dollars on video. And they're made enough money, they're making another one. So that comic that went like 6 issues in like 1994 paid for itself like a million times over.
But nobody will make a Love and Rockets movie.
Well, in that instance, and I probably should know the answer to this, and I could probably actually ask, but it could very well be they've never wanted to sell the rights to have it made into a movie.
Have you had the brothers on the podcast yet?
I have not had them on the podcast, but I interviewed Jaime for the issue of the magazine last year when I wrote the article about Lucha and Love and Rockets. So I believe I offered email interview or podcast, and he said written interview, and that was fine with me. I was happy to talk to him, however it may have been. So, but I know people who, you know, that used to be the joke in the late 90s was, like, how successful was your Comic-Con? And it was successful if you got somebody from Hollywood to option your book. Even if you knew they were never going to make it, it still got optioned and you got a check for free, basically.
Yeah.
Or it paid off all the work that you did leading up to that. Because I used to be, you know, sit with friends in Artist Alley, and yeah, I think I saw like one guy have like meet like 3 different agency people. I think like over the course of the week I was there and saw 3 different guys come up and talk, you know, here's my card, you know, let's talk about something one day, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, so maybe for some people, the Hollywood people being there is good because it gets them free money. But I know I've had a conversation with somebody who said, yeah, my book's been optioned like three different times. You know, like it's been optioned and the rights have lapsed, and then somebody else picked it up, and then 2 years later, somebody picks it up, and he's like, it's never going to get made, but it's, you know, money
Yeah,
for old rope,
money,
as
money,
they
money.
say. And
And you.
when you're a struggling artist creator type who probably does not have, you know, the most solid of bank accounts, generally speaking, it's a good thing.
Yes, the fluctuating bank account from 1 month things look sunny, and then the next seven they don't look so sunny.
You know, my goal was to do a short show and not keep you all night. Unfortunately, I don't think it's happened.
That's all right. I'm in good stead. We still haven't talked about coral shaped uniforms for a team that calls itself the Blues.
Oh, yeah, and as timely as today's
Is this
headlines,
going to
we
be
have.
their away kit, or is it just the away kit for the six preseason games?
The black and orange one.
Yeah, the ones
That's
today
their
with the
awake.
coral neckbands.
I don't know. I know their away kit is the one that's black that has like the orange accents. I don't know. Maybe they're playing. I didn't see any pictures, so maybe they're playing in their third kit today.
Yeah,
Because some of the third kits, so
I'm going from memory, but this was because it was because I was groggy when I woke up this morning. But as I was reading the official Everton FC Twitter, I thought that's what they were trying to imply, that this was going to be the away kit this year. But it could have been the away kit just for the preseason games.
well, let's take a look.
But is EPL the same thing as Major League Baseball, where they deliberately try and have all sorts of different uniforms and caps and et cetera, solely for the financial ability to resell them to completists and fans?
Yes, because the one thing I will credit North American sports for is generally there's a cooling down period where you can only change your uniform like once every 3 years, once every 4 years, something like that. Whereas in European football, people they change every year. And I mean, the designs at least change every year. It's entirely possible that they change manufacturers repeatedly, so that's going to
Well,
change.
generally, who's the impetus behind that? Is it the sponsor or the club?
I would have to think for football, it's probably the club. And then I'm sure that the manufacturers are the ones who come up with, hey, last year our away kit was fuchsia. This year, let's make it orange, and then next year it'll be aquamarine. Because one of the weird things about away kits is some of them, if people who knew about the club made them, they wouldn't make them. Like, a couple times over the last few years, Manchester United's away kit has been blue. And not the same shade of blue as Manchester City. But still, there's like if you listen to the Men in Blazers, they like the sort of universal truth of football is you're a red or a blue, generally speaking.
Generally, yes.
So if you're a blue team, you do not want to have a kit that's red. And you also have to factor in the whole thing that the point of the change kit, which, I mean, it's sort of technically different than just being home and away, because generally team, you know, there's only a handful of teams that actually wear white, and that's their gimmick. Like Tottenham wears white, Real Madrid wears white, but you know, but people's colors are their brand. I hate saying brand, but you know, especially because there's a lot of teams that don't even have real nicknames. It's the thing where, you know, Liverpool are the Reds, Chelsea are the Blues. Yeah, it's what they're called.
Everton are the Blues.
So, well, it's weird. Everton are, they're also the Toffees and,
well,
you know, they're
the anti-Liverpools.
Yeah, and they're, you know, the Evertonians. And but see, it's a thing where if you look at these things, it's Liverpool is, generally speaking, red or blue. Manchester, generally speaking, is red or blue. Now, London has like 20 teams, so it's not that easy. But, you know, Arsenal's red, Chelsea's blue. Tottenham's white, Fulham's white. You know, West Ham are one of many teams that are claret and blue. Because, you know, these teams are all 200 years old-ish, or 150 years old-ish. So, you know, back then you only had like four colors to choose from. That's also like why so many teams are like black and white stripes, blue and red and white stripes. Because, you know, what did you have to choose from in 1860?
Not any fuchsia and not any coral.
So, it looks like the training kit is the orange with like the black and white. Because the away kit is black and the home kit is obviously blue. And they, I don't think they've announced the third color yet. You know, the change kit is supposed to be Everton's blue, Chelsea's blue. Well, when we play each other, we can't both be blue. So somebody has to wear something else. So that's why they're called change kits and not just home and away. Because, and then sometimes, although not really rarely, you know, home team will wear not their home kit. That's usually marketing.
Thanks, Steve, for your time, and we'll talk to everybody next time. Thanks for listening.